This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in this week for Terry Gross. 4 years ago, Thomas Frank's influential book, What's the Matter with Kansas, argued that conservatives have effectively used social issues to convince many in the heartland to vote against their economic interests. In his new book, The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule, Frank takes on conservatives in public office. He argues that stories of incompetence in government, from Katrina relief to Reconstruction in Iraq, are no accident. He says because conservatives don't believe in government, when elected, they systematically degrade and dismantle the machinery of state. Thomas Frank is a regular columnist for the Wall Street Journal and is the founding editor of The Baffler, a journal of cultural and political criticism. Well, Thomas Frank, welcome back to Fresh Air. Your new book is about how conservatives rule, how they approach government. And you write that the conservative movement really picked up steam, the sort of grassroots conservative organizing, when conservatives found that right-wing activism could be a profitable business. You make money by doing this. How do they make money?
Yeah, that's sort of one of the critical realizations that I came to while I was doing the research for this book, was that conservatism isn't just a political movement, it's also an industry. And this is something that began in the 1970s with what's called direct mail. Your listeners might know it as junk mail, but you get those solicitations in the mail from political groups, and they're always pretty shrill and pretty outrageous, and they're asking for money on the grounds that something really, really awful is going to happen if you don't give the money. And when this first started, it was only conservatives doing it in the beginning. And your listeners might remember some of the issues, like the famous Panama Canal giveaway. But there was dozens of different ones, and this turned out to be a very lucrative business, the direct mail field. And that's sort of the beginning, in the way I see it, of conservatism as industry. It wasn't something where big business types or even small business types gave money and just lost money, put it into politics in order to further their interests. It was something. It was a form of politics that actually could make money on its own. And then defund the left was sort of the second stage in that, where conservative activists would go out and market themselves as, essentially as class warriors.
One of the basic messages of your book is that when we see incompetence in government these days, it's not necessarily an accident, that it is the purpose of conservatives when they get in power to wreck the machinery of government. And you say that conservatives, beginning with Reagan and continuing since then, have systematically destroyed the civil service system. Explain how this has been done.
Well, we should start with the ideology itself. And one of the most interesting documents that I came across while I was doing the research for this book is an interview from 1928 with a guy who had been the president of the Chamber of Commerce of the United States, and he said, had this sort of immortal statement that was kind of well known at the time. He said, "The best public servant is the worst one." And what he meant by that is that you shouldn't have highly qualified people in government, because that would just lead government to be effective. Then people would trust government to do things well, and government would inevitably start taking away, start regulating the private sector, taking away power from the private sector, and then it's a slippery slope to communism or something like that. This is an idea that conservatives repeat all the time, that you shouldn't have the best people in government, because, as I said, they think that the private sector is more important. That's where the best and the brightest should be. And if you have really talented people in the public sector, they're going to grab for power. They're going to take power away from its rightful holders, which means, of course, business. That's the ideology of it. The practice of it during the Reagan administration, and then continuing here during the Bush administration. And I should also say, I don't want to let Clinton off the hook here either. He wasn't much better than either Reagan or Bush in this regard. But the practice has been to alienate and antagonize the federal workforce, to call them all sorts of names, especially under Reagan, where the federal workforce were supposed to be something close to devils. The conservative movement refers to them as the permanent government, and they're supposed to have, according to sort of conservative mythology, the bureaucracy is supposed to have an agenda of its own, and it's the job of conservatives to make sure that they aren't able to grab power for themselves, and they aren't able to run with their agenda, that they have to do what conservatives want. So you have to, you know, gain control over the bureaucracy. You have to crack heads. You have to bring the tanks up, as one Reagan official very famously put it.
Let's talk about how it works. How specifically would civil servants be attacked, devalued, demoralized?
Well, the best statistic that you can point to is something that they call the pay gap, or that they used to call it that. You really don't hear about it very much anymore. But back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, the government used to measure the differential in wages between public sector workers, you know, federal bureaucrats, what they were paid and what people in the private sector doing the same work were paid. And that's how they would they did these elaborate studies on this, because that's how they decided how much to pay the federal workers. Now, one of the other things is you could look at these numbers and see that public sector workers were always paid slightly less than private sector people doing the same job. And they'd say, well, that's because public sector workers have, you know, excellent benefits. They have job security. They have really good pension plans and that sort of thing. So it wasn't much of a problem back in the 50s and the 60s and in the 70s. And then under Reagan, the pay gap, what they called the pay gap, started to really open up wide. And by 1990, it was at something like 40% for people in the top federal jobs. Their private sector analogs were getting, you know, people doing the same work in the private sector were making 40% more than public sector workers doing exactly the same thing. And then they changed the standard of measuring it. So now, I mean, that was in 1990. So we really don't know what it is now. I assume it's gotten much worse just based on anecdotal evidence. There's something that we have here in Washington, you know, another great Washington term called the revolving door, where people go from the public sector into the private sector, you know, often to do the same work, often to lobby their former colleagues, but they're paid much, much, much more in the private sector. Now, one of the sort of the other side of this coin is that conservatives believe in government by the private sector. George W. Bush, a statement of his that I refer to a lot in my new book, where he said government should be market-based. And just think about that for a second. Government should be market-based. What does he mean by that? Well, what it turns out that he means in practice is this sort of massive privatization and contracting out of federal work. So you have, you know, at something like FEMA, at an agency like FEMA, you'll have, you know, someone who's a federal employee sitting at one desk, and the guy sitting at the desk next to him will be the employee of some private company, and he'll just by chance, you know, as it happens, be making, you know, a lot more money, but he'll be working there in the same building. They'll be working on the same thing. There's one critical difference, though. The federal worker ultimately answers to you and me. The guy that works for the private contractor answers to shareholders. He answers to his boss.
You know, in the 1990s, there was this move towards privatization of some government functions. I mean, during the Clinton administration, Al Gore headed something called Reinventing Government in state and local governments everywhere. And I think the idea was that, at least the way it was presented, was that government, when over time had become indifferent and unaccountable and inefficient, and that there were certain functions that would be better handled by private industry. How did this work out in terms of its effect on the civil service employees and on its effect on public services?
Well, contracting out is the real story of Washington, D.C. As you drive around the famous Capitol Beltway, you know, the big highway that goes around the city, you'll see the people who really govern us. And it's not, you know, the poor bureaucrat down in the Department of Labor. It's these people in these sort of glamorous glass office buildings with the names of the great federal contractors on them. And that's who really does the business of governing now. And they do it for, you know, they make a lot more money at it than the bureaucrats ever did. Whether or not they've done a good job, I mean, that's a pretty easy question to answer. They've done a really, really, really bad job. I mean, in the Bush administration, which has made such a push to privatize and outsource every possible federal job, you think of the three great initiatives of the Bush administration: Homeland Security, Katrina recovery, and Iraq reconstruction. And each one of these has just been the most incredible botch and also fantastically expensive. What always gets me about the whole move for privatization and contracting was that it was supposed to, I mean, this is the fig leaf, it was supposed to save money. I mean, that was the idea. It was supposed to save the public money. And in fact, it's turned out to be just fantastically expensive. The real purpose, of course, is to, hand off power away from what these people that conservatives hate, what they call the permanent government, the bureaucrats, take the power away from them and hand it over to private corporations. And those private corporations, I mean, it's not a coincidence at all. Just as it happens, most of them tend to be big, big contributors to the Republican Party. You know, getting back to industry conservatism, they tend to be big, big supporters of the conservative movement industry.
We're speaking with Thomas Frank. His new book is The Wrecking Crew: How Conservatives Rule. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with Thomas Frank. His latest book is The Wrecking Crew: How Conservatives Rule. You know, I have to say, as I read the book, and you were talking about how civil servants, those who over the years have devoted their lives to serving the public and the government, have been demoralized and displaced and driven out by conservatives who see that as their mission. You know, as somebody who's covered local government for 20 years, I mean, I can tell you, I mean, I've seen plenty of cases, particularly in the 90s, where public-spirited folks came in, and I've known a lot of great civil servants over the years who do their jobs and do it well. But there are plenty of cases, it seems to me, where people get into a bureaucratic mentality where they can become unaccountable and indifferent to the public. And sometimes introducing some privatization gets unions, gets civil service workers to think in a different way about what they're doing, and sometimes serve the public better. I mean, do you think that any privatization initiative is driven by a conservative zeal to destroy the government?
Oh, and I'm not saying every single one. I'm sure there are many operations that richly deserve to be privatized. For example, the building of weapons. The government has never built its own weapons systems, going all the way back. But at the same time, the problem these days isn't pointing out what you just said, that that there are bureaucrats who don't do their jobs well and who get into a bureaucratic mentality. I mean, every third grader in America knows that. You know, that's part of the myth of the movement that has dominated our lives for the last 30 years. The really interesting thing to me is that bureaucracies do work well in a lot of situations. That's why we have them. I mean, that's why they were built in the first place. You go back to the 1930s, the Works Progress Administration, one of the first, giant bureaucracies the Roosevelt administration set up. And it's amazing to me how well they were able to do complex tasks, put people to work. I was just up in rural Vermont, and I went into a little post office, and it had these beautiful murals that had been painted in the 30s by the WPA. They had found some artist who was out of work, and they'd given the guy a job painting these murals. And the thing to remember nowadays is that bureaucracy does work in lots of situations. That's why we have it. It is an advanced form of getting complex tasks done.
But it seems to me there's a difference between a bureaucracy whose goal is to regulate private conduct, to make our food safer and protect the environment and permit fair rules for unionizing workplace. A difference between that and bureaucracies that deliver a service to the city, that picks up the trash, that collects its taxes, et cetera. And there are cases in which those service delivery systems can become ossified and indifferent and unaccountable, and that shaking them up sometimes by privatizing some pieces of it actually helps. There are some functions that maybe government doesn't do so well, and that's why I'm just questioning whether.
That's certainly correct. Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with you on that. Yeah. I mean, there certainly are those. There certainly are many situations where that's true.
You write in the book. I mean, you talk about the lobbying culture, and one of the points you make is that the lobbyists are there to, in effect, turn the government over to market forces. But it struck me that this is one of the ways in which conservatism has changed over the decades, is that it seems to me that maybe many decades ago, conservatives believed in a true free market notion, that government should stay out of regulation, it should lower taxes, it should let business compete. But it seems to me that so much of this now is really based upon business interests that they don't want competition. They want a fix. They want sweetheart contracts. They want customized tax credits and bailouts and selective tariffs and little niche regulatory exemptions. In a way, they don't want government to shrink and die. They want it to feed them, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. The thing is that is conservatism in action. Conservatism has always talked laissez-faire, but it's always delivered this other thing, which is, you know, extravagant favors to private industry. And it seems like a contradiction. And in fact, there's, you know, several think tanks here in D.C. that specialize in the idea, in sort of selling the idea that the conservative movement is filled with imposters and traitors. And because nobody's ever a true conservative, once they get into power, all they do is these sweetheart deals for private industry. But what you find is that this is what conservatism is. This is what the animal looks like in the field. This is how it behaves. This is always what it does. This is as laissez-faire as you're going to get. These, you know, no-bid contracts for Lockheed Martin or whatever the hell it is.
You know, one of the interesting things about your book is the language that you use. It at times reads like a rant on a block. I mean, you describe Duke Cunningham, the congressman who was convicted and I believe sentenced to 8 years on corruption charges, as a conservative of distinctly Neanderthal tendency. And at one point you use the phrase, the wingnuts and chiselers who have been our subjects thus far. It's funny. But
chiseler is a great word. That's not a blog word. That's a 19th century word. That word needs to be brought back.
Right. Okay.
I'm not a blogger. I don't blog. I do.
I guess what I'm getting at is, I mean, a lot of people talk about kind of the poisonous atmosphere of partisanship in Washington and the need to have reasoned civil discussion of ideas. And you're really swinging for the fences with this stuff.
Well, come on, Duke Cunningham. The guy is. I mean, there. He's as disgraced as they
disgraced his office, but was a decorated Navy pilot nonetheless.
That's true. And as a kid, I thought he was hot stuff. I've changed my mind about him now. But yeah, he flew that Phantom jet. I mean, he was the greatest. I mean, it's a real letdown. I mean, a lot of the people that I met with and that I interviewed are very sophisticated, you know, highly intelligent people. You know, you think of a guy like Grover Norquist, very, very smart guy. Or you think of a man like Richard Viguerie, who's associated with Direct Mail,
an honorable
fellow, you know, a very a convincing, fatherly. I like the guy. There's a lot of conservatives that I'm very fond of. I think it's totally fair game to go after Duke Cunningham. Let me just add that, you know, the language of blogs, that's not me. My language is it's straight out of, you know, 1930s, 1920s, 19-teens, muckraking literature. That's what I come from.
You know, I wanted to ask
you to say, hey, Frank, you were born in 1965. And never, but it's that's what I read. I mean, that's what I spend my spare time reading. And I think to call somebody a mountebank when they are one is perfectly fair.
And explain that for our listeners.
Yeah. A mountebank?
Yeah, I forgot.
That's a fraud.
Right, right. You know, your last book, What's the Matter with Kansas, was about how some voters were persuaded, you believe, to vote against their own economic interest. I'm wondering how some of the political currents that you saw in that book are playing out in this election.
I think that the idea in What's the Matter with Kansas was that culture war issues had come to take the place of class issues, because, you know, the culture war issues are always framed in terms of class, and we see the Republicans desperately trying to use this language to beat Obama. You know, they're always talking about him as a liberal elitist and running through the sort of the list of stereotypes. And what's very interesting to me this time around is that it's not working. It's not sticking to him. And in many other respects, the culture war issues are failing this time around. And I think that could be because the economic situation is so much more dire now that it's impossible to brush it off and say, you know, the real class villain in America is intellectuals or something like that. It's just nobody's going to buy that when gas is $4 a gallon and you can't afford, you know, milk for the kids and stuff like that.
Thomas Frank, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
Thomas Frank's new book is The Wrecking Crew: How Conservatives Rule. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.